Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly recap of Utah news by the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pearson. This week on the program, the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, the DABC, is tightening up on one-time event licenses. It's a move that could jeopardize selling beer at Snowbird's annual Oktoberfest. Why the rule change, and why now? Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker wants to ban fireworks displays in the name of air quality, but will the city council go along? And a group of Mormon women changes tactics in making their case for priesthood ordination. How will the new strategy play with the faithful? All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pearce. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pearce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, fireworks, Orrin Hatch, ordained women, Oktoberfest, much more. And joining me this morning is Tribune Salt Lake County reporter Mike Gorrell. Mike, hi.
Good morning.
Also with us, religion writer Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, great to have you.
Hello.
And editorial writer George Pyle. George, welcome.
Good morning.
And government and politics editor Dan Harry. Hey, Dan.
Morning, Jennifer.
And you can join us, too. What headlines have you been talking about around the water cooler this week? You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put comments at sltrib.com. You can also give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Peggy, let's start with you. Let's get a little religion going. Ordained Women, the group of Mormon women who are pushing for priesthood ordination, announced they're shifting their focus a little bit this week. What did they announce?
They decided that the next step in their strategy, their first step was to try to get tickets to the all-male priesthood session of LDS General Conference. They started doing that last October, then they tried again in April. That was their way of showing their, as they said, readiness for priesthood. But they've now decided the next step is to try to create little discussion groups to get grassroots support for their efforts. They put out something called Six Discussions, where they talk about history, theology, etc., reasons why they think women should have the priesthood in the LDS Church, encouraging women to form little groups to talk about these things. Part of their materials included patriarchy bingo.
So, patriarchy bingo, I want to play that. Why the change in strategy?
I think that they just feel that there are various ways to approach this topic, and that perhaps, I can't speak for them, but they've talked about trying to gather more support at least have the church know that there are many more than just the couple hundred who showed up at Temple Square, that in fact there are quite a few females in the LDS Church who are interested in priesthood ordination.
The new strategy launched last week. Do you have any sense of how it's going?
I really haven't followed up to know how. I know some groups have started and have used the talking points, but how widespread or any kind of numbers, no idea at this point.
Meanwhile, the church's main spokesman is saying that the pro-ordination discussion is a bit of a distraction from the real discussion about the role of women in the church. Can you just briefly tell us what Michael Otterson said?
Yes, he put out a statement late yesterday that said that the church PR department, as well as church leaders, have met with many different kinds of groups of women to talk about these issues, but they are not interested in talking to ordained women or other, as they put it, sort of more extreme groups who have one goal in mind, but that they are definitely still gathering information from Mormon women.
Well, it's interesting about the timing. Why did he decide to make this statement? It was quite lengthy, and it was put on a prominent Mormon blog.
Right. I'm not in his head, so I have no idea why he chose this timing or this venue. But from the tone of it, seemed like he felt that the church PR department particularly was misunderstood in its statements and wanted to defend and clarify.
And the statement said that the church doesn't want to meet with those who make non-negotiable demands. Is that how ordained women sees themselves, making non-negotiable demands?
Well, they definitely would not use those terms. They don't see these as demands. They don't say non-negotiable. They do see female ordination as their end goal, but they don't describe themselves as activists. They describe themselves as faithful Latter-day Saints who are simply asking church leaders to pray about it. And that seems like different kind of language than non-negotiable.
And this was from the church's public relations wing. It was not from a church official, a church leader. Does that say anything?
Yes, but he also made it clear in his point, in his statement, that the church PR wing would never do anything that didn't have the full approval of their bosses, who are church officials. So, in essence, he was saying, we are representing the point of view of the hierarchs.
Okay. Well, that's certainly an issue that we will continue to watch, and you will continue to cover. Another Mormon issue that came up this week, a meeting of Mormons who want to stay Mormon but who are also gay, lesbian, or transgender. Tell us about this group sponsoring an event happening this weekend in Provo, North Star.
North Star is a relatively new organization for Mormon gays and lesbians. Last year emerged with Evergreen, which is a more long-standing group. And these are people who support the church's position that homosexuality is not a choice, but that in order to continue to be a faithful member, the main option is celibacy. On the other hand, the church has also softened language and talked about loving gays and lesbians and embracing them, that sort of thing. So this North Star group is having workshops to talk about coping with homosexuality, with being gay, staying within the faith, how to speak about it. It has little workshops for family members, for friends, what not to say, that kind of thing.
So it's with the gay lifestyle. It's not a choice, but it's a cross to bear, kind of.
Yeah, that seems to be the church's perspective.
Okay. This week you wrote about a man named Tom Christofferson, who is gay. He has been for years in a very committed relationship, and yet he recently decided to return to his Mormon roots. He's part of this event, but tell us the story.
Yes, he will be speaking about his experience, which is not in its sum of its aspects, not too dissimilar from other Mormon gays. Grew up in a big committed Mormon family, went to BYU, went on a mission, briefly was married to a woman, but that didn't work, and realized the depth of his attractions were not going away. Actually went through an excommunication proceeding from the church, settled in with a partner, male partner, for literally decades, and about 7 years ago sort of yearned to be back with the community, so began to attend church in Connecticut and was actually welcomed by his Mormon bishop, who said, yes, come to church, bring your, you know, have your partner come to church. And he is now pretty involved, moderately involved, I would say. And he will be speaking about that experience.
And I guess the unique aspect of his experience is his relationship. He has a brother in the top leadership of the church.
Yes, his brother is Todd Christofferson, who's an apostle.
Interesting story. Meanwhile, Mormons sympathetic to the LGBT rights movement will not be allowed to march in the Days of 47 parade, traditionally the Mormon celebration of the state's founding. Mike, you've been reporting this week that despite the parade's decision, the Salt Lake City Council is still going to participate.
Right. They gave some consideration to the boycotting the event because they clearly don't agree with the parade organizers' decision to ban Mormons building bridges from the parade. But they ultimately came to the conclusion that the parade is about the founding of Salt Lake City, and they are the Salt Lake City Council, so it's their responsibility to participate in that event. But they've also decided to send a strong letter to the organizers saying, we disagree with your decision, please reconsider it. And they've also laid out the possibility, well, you know, as city council members, we can't bring our kids to on the parade with us, but we can bring a guest. And so maybe one of the council members will bring Jim DeBacchus, who's openly gay, or some other gay person to go along with them in the parade.
So. And are they all committed to be there, or as individuals, may some of them opt out?
They may opt out. Not everyone said what they were going to do that the meeting Tuesday night, but they did say that if you want to stay home and as a sign of protest, go ahead.
George Pyle, good move on the city council's part?
Well, as he said, I mean, this is about the founding of Salt Lake City, and you heard the Salt Lake City mayor and council, and it would be kind of impolite not to show up. This all happened kind of rapidly. You know, they have to think about next year. By next year, if the church has had more time to reconsider who they will and won't allow, and the city has had more time to consider whether this is really the sort of thing they want to participate in, it may turn out differently. This parade's coming up pretty soon, and to force the church to change its mind or boycott it was probably something they didn't want to force in such short order. And to make it more controversial than it already is, I can understand why the city council wouldn't want to go there, at least not this year.
Mike, did council members express they were getting some pressure from people on either side of the issue?
No, I don't think so. It just seemed to me at the meeting that they were just expressing their own opinions. I think they have a pretty good feel for how the public feels about it all.
Mm-hmm. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Mike Gorell, also with us editorial writer George Pyle, government and politics editor Dan Harry. Peggy Fletcher-Stack, I know you've got to get on your way, but thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. You can join us as well, 801-355-TALK. You can send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And here in the studio, Tribune editorial writer George Pyle, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and reporter Mike Gorell. And we're talking about the week's headlines. If you want to join us, you can call 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can put your comments online at sltrib.com. You can also send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. Let's talk about one of the best headlines I've seen in a long time. Oktoberfest without beer? ? That's what the State Liquor Commission hinted at during its meeting this week. Dan, what's the deal?
Right. So this involves another one of Utah's rather arcane liquor laws, and it involves what's called a special event permit. And these special event permits are usually granted to some group that puts on an event. It's a short-term thing. They're not going to establish a tavern or a club or a restaurant, but it's just an event where they want to serve alcohol for a short period of time. So the Oktoberfest, which happens in, you know, October at Snowbird.
Actually starts in August.
In August. Okay, yeah. Sorry. Well,
we're in a hurry.
It's a long celebration.
It goes to October.
It goes to October. But it's for, you know, people to get out in the summer and get up in the mountains and, you know, drink some good beer, have a good time.
And the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, the DABC, says it's tightening up on these one-time event permits, reserving those for community groups that promote a common good. So it sort of gives the nonprofits, the charities, a bit of an advantage. But why?
Well, you know, they say that they're doing it because they're following state law, that the rule exists, that it hasn't been closely enough observed, and that this is clearly intended for charitable groups, and that the Oktoberfest doesn't qualify as a charitable organization. And so, you know, they've been suggesting a couple of things, which is, well, nothing prevents them from serving 3.2% alcohol beer, which, you know, that's kind of not, that's going to kind of undermine that event.
It's beer, but it's not the heavy beer that people want at Oktoberfest.
Exactly. And, you know, that's probably just not going to fly with the folks who attend that event and the ones who put it on. It sort of is reminiscent of what the Alcoholic Beverage Commission Control Commission did. Was it about a year or two ago where they wanted to crack down on, you know, another rule that existed for a long time, which said if you're going to go into a restaurant that serves alcohol, you actually have to order your food before you can get served a drink. And they got tremendous blowback from that, from restaurants and patrons, saying, you know, this is ridiculous. This has never been enforced like this before. That, and they eventually backed off. This one, I don't know that there's going to be that kind of blowback, but it'll be interesting to see. It's another one of these issues where, you know, tradition has been going on for many, many years, and the commission decides all of a sudden, now we're going to tighten that up.
Talking about the Oktoberfest issue, and if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. And let's go to the phones. JD's been holding from Salt Lake City. JD, hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, I'm very familiar with this entire issue from the standpoint of going to Snowbird, going to Deer Valley, eating with people from out of town, looking at how complicated, you know, it is. And the idea that, you know, Snowbird needs 17 licenses to function, and Deer Valley probably needs, you know, 100 out there, and Park City probably has hundreds of licenses, and the bureaucrats have to visit these places many times a year. And that's the travesty, that everybody there, I promise you, there aren't kids trying to buy a $14 martini at any of these places, I promise you. They're not trying to buy a $9 beer. They're adults that are paying $4,500 a day to ski at Deer Valley, for God's sake. They and when they sit around determining where they're going to go next, it you know, that's they're sitting around going, I can't walk over there and get my beer and bring it to this table. And to stay in the corral, and anyway, it's aggravating and it's a travesty.
JD, thanks very much for the call. Interestingly, JD brings up a point about the multiple licenses that Snowbird already has. I believe the number is actually 19 various alcohol permits for the restaurants and bars on the premises. So funny that the law restricts one from taking a drink purchased inside, under a roof, outdoors to a patio setting. And that's not allowed. The DABC director, Sal Patillo, says he's just implementing the law. Do you think that the Oktoberfest discussion is going to usher in further conversation among lawmakers about how to sort of tweak this law and accommodate these outdoor festivals that we see popping up all over the summer? George Pyle?
Well, I'm sure they'll come back to it. I mean, a state that on the one hand talks about how important business generation is, about attracting business to come and locate here, about attracting conventions to come here, and they're on about that all the time. And then with the other hand, they say, but if you want to do what every other business gathering in the universe does, which is have alcohol with your dinner or with your reception, then you have to jump through all these hoops. And maybe we won't even give you a license at all because just because. Even after we've been doing it for 40 years, we'll start reading the rules that have been there forever differently. Mm. Now, there's lots of ways that you can do things and make deals. The legislature could help everybody save face by passing another law. And there are a lot of states where you have everything from whether you can serve alcohol to whether you can have a Las Vegas night to whether you can have a lottery to whether you can do all kinds of things. If you hang some charitable thing onto the end of it that's a beneficiary, and maybe Snowbird could do that. They could adopt a charity for Oktoberfest and give the charity a certain amount of the cut, and then it would be a charitable enterprise. Other people might object to that and say, well, look, you're just trying to exploit a loophole, and so we're not going to let you do that. The sudden discovery that what Snowbird has been doing for 40 years has been illegal all along, it just makes the state look ridiculous. And I would hope that the Alcohol Commission would do what they did with the, no drink until you've actually ordered your prime rib, which is to say, well, on second thought, this is long established. And the rule is long and verbose and lists a whole lot of reasons why you might want one of these. And to say that, to read the rule to say, there's no way we could read this rule to say that Snowbird can't do what it's doing is a bit of a stretch.
Well, to give the preference to organizations that benefit a charity or something, I mean, this is big bucks for Snowbird, Mike Gorell. I mean, you cover the ski resorts. They need this summer business, right?
Yeah, this is probably the biggest off-ski season event that they have and has been for a long time. It dwarfs everything else that they have during the summer. So, yeah, it's important to them.
Where do you think this is going to go? Dan Harry, any thoughts? Do you think that the DABC really will shut down Oktoberfest?
I doubt that. I think, as George said, there might be some discovery of a loophole that allows them to declare themselves as a charitable event. The problem with that is, at what level of giving does it qualify as a charity? And who decides that? Does the DABC decide that? And on what basis do they decide that? I think it just once again underlines, what is the real overriding goal of the DABC? Is it to keep alcohol away from minors? Is it to really try to curb overconsumption? If those are the two things that they're really out there trying to do, it seems like they could do a lot better, more efficient job of doing that.
Mm. Well, I was out with a group of people last night, and the overall consensus was that all this was really an effort to impose the moral perspective of the dominant culture on everybody else. That, well, ultimately, that's what it all comes down to and how people will remember it.
That's probably true. On the other hand, the state makes an awful lot of money off of alcohol sales in this state, and they would be pretty hard-pressed to give up all that revenue.
Right, but as George said, they're also pro-business all the time, and this is attacking a business in a vital interest for them.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it is a matter of culture, because it's kind of, as the caller said, if you're worried about underage drinking, binge drinking, then you're worried about, buying a 5-gallon jug of wine for $1 or something and going off behind the barn and drinking it all by yourself. When a beer is $9 and a cocktail is $13, and you're also in a place where you're spending a lot of other money on bratwurst and everything else, this is not where people binge drink. This is not where people go from being an upstanding teetotaler to a lush overnight. And to just not understand that culture is a failing, I think, that the DABC has. It's just like a whole different language that they don't even speak.
Mm. Well, we're talking about tinkering with tradition. Let's move on to fireworks. Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker wants to make a statement about clean air. Mike, what's his plan?
He took $25,000 out of the budget that he's proposed for the fiscal year that starts July the 1st, and that would do away with fireworks at Jordan Park and Liberty Park, a couple of small events that are held annually and have been community gathering points. And his point is that if we're going to be leaders in the fight against air quality, we have to kind of, in this case, not put our money where our mouth is and take the money away and not contribute to air pollution by shooting off fireworks.
Is it purely a budget decision? Or is this, could he just decide to revoke fireworks permits citywide? Mike?
I don't know if he can revoke them citywide or not, but he one of the arguments that the city council has raised in not going along with this is that this is such a token thing. These are two small events, and at the same time, the Salt Lake Bees shoot off fireworks maybe 9 or 10 times during the course of the summer, and Sugar House Park, which the city supports morally, but it doesn't financially because it's an independent organization. It's a huge event, and it draws a lot more and creates a lot more air pollution than the city's two little events do.
So what does the city council, where are they coming on this? Are they split? Do they have to decide?
Well, yeah, they have to decide because it's part of the budget. I would say that there was unanimity among members of the city council at Tuesday's meeting that while they applaud the mayor's goal and fully support clean air, that this is not the right approach to doing it. That it's just it's too symbolic. It doesn't have very many practical effects. And Aaron Mendenhall, who's a member of the city council and was just recently appointed to the Utah Board of Air Quality, her point was that, you know, rather than just eliminating these out of a blanket policy, we should look at the air quality situation that exists on that day. And if there is a problem where adding fine particulates from fireworks blowing up creates a health problem, well, we'll cut it out. Obviously, it won't be appropriate a lot of times on New Year's because we have inversions then and the air quality is terrible. So, sure, no fireworks then. But the 4th of July and the 24th of July, ozone is our main pollution problem at that time, and PM10, PM2.5 aren't. And those would be the byproducts of the fireworks shows. And the other argument that the council has really put forth is that if you take away these two fireworks shows, all you're going to do is drive people to go to Evanston or anywhere in Wyoming and get a lot worse air polluting fireworks and then start shooting them off in their backyards.
George, what do you think? What do you think about Becker's plan?
Well, I mean, air quality is what the mayor is just devoting this year and his whole term to. His last State of the City address, instead of being a checklist of all these things, which State of the State, State of the City addresses are usually about, was all about air quality. And so, and everything that he is known for, bicycle lanes, mass transit, all these other things, air quality is his big issue. So you can understand why he would say, well, you know, if air quality is my big issue, maybe I shouldn't be writing a check for people to foul the air. But it is pretty symbolic. I don't think the council's going to go along with it. I don't think the community is going to go along with it. The other fireworks issue on the 4th and the 24th is individuals shooting off fireworks in their backyards in the street. Some of them are legal, some of them aren't. I mean, the legislature adjusts this all the time. I always used to say that if the legislature met in July, they might ban fireworks, but they don't, so they've all forgotten about it by the next January. And if you're going to do anything to encourage more people to buy more fireworks, shoot them off in their backyard, start fires, frighten the dogs, and do all that kind of thing, you'd probably be better off inviting everybody to come to Liberty Park and watch a professional managed fireworks show where the fire department's already there and you have that control over it.
So, Mike, the Becker proposal is really about the city-sponsored events. It's not talking about the Bees games, like you mentioned.
No, they can't. They can't influence that. It's just the two Liberty Park and Jordan Park events.
Okay, so if people want to chime in and give their two cents on this proposal, how do they do that?
Well, Tuesday night, the City Council is having its second public hearing on the budget, in advance of adoption in mid-June. So that would be the time for people to weigh in.
Okay. Let's move on to...
Can I just throw one thing
Dan
in there?
Yes, Dan Harry.
I got to say, as a neighbor of Representative Jim Dunnigan, the legislature will never do away with fireworks, and I don't care when they meet.
That's probably true.
Okay, let me add one thing, though. What the city council has decided to do is they're not going to put the full $25,000 into fireworks. They're going to put probably $15,000 into it and put the other $10,000 into other forms of recreation that they can make those community gatherings more fun. In looking at the future of maybe switching over to lasers or some other things that would not be polluting.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on that, Mike. Thanks for the update. Let's move on to congressional politics. Utah senior senator got in a bit of a jam this week over comments he made on Memorial Day. Dan Harry, what did he say?
Well, most of what he said during an...
I should say Orrin Hatch we're talking about.
Right, Orrin Hatch. Most of what he said during an 18-minute speech at Woods Cross during a Memorial Day commemoration was about military men and women and people who had sacrificed their lives, including his own brother Jesse, who died in World War II. And Senator Hatch often tells that story in a very heartfelt way. But then toward the end of the speech, he kind of drifted off into talking about the Supreme Court, the Hobby Lobby case, religious liberty, the upcoming election in November, the importance of the 2016 election in determining the makeup of the Supreme Court, and talked about he would push a constitutional amendment if the Supreme Court screws up or fouls up, in his words, the Hobby Lobby case. And that had been preceded by an introduction by the Woods Cross mayor, Rick Earnshaw, which talked about the unconstitutional individual mandate provision of the Obamacare, of the Affordable Care Act.
So lots of politics.
Lots of politics. I mean, in that whole, scope of that event, it was a small amount of verbiage devoted to politics. But I think that people who go to these events and expect, an event devoted to the fallen dead during wartime, which is what the Veterans of Foreign Wars and Terry Schau, who's probably the strongest advocate for military and veterans in this state, said that's what these should be devoted to. And whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, an independent or apolitical, you should be able to go to these events and join with your community celebrating and commemorating without the introduction of polarizing politics.
And Senator Hatch did apologize later, sort of.
Well, he gave one of those, if I have offended anyone, apologies. Take it at what you will, whether that's an apology or not. But
he also had some things to say about gay marriage this week, and saying it's pretty much over, folks. It will be legal. A bit of a surprise.
It surprised me. It happened on the Doug Wright Show on KSL, and he very strongly said that if you don't recognize that we're headed toward legal gay marriage as the law of the land, then you're not living in reality. And, if you look at the evidence of the court cases, I think there have been 14 decisions in different states. Every one of them now has been in favor of legal same-sex marriage. Of course, the Supreme Court will decide this, those are tea leaves to read. But if you look back at the DOMA decision, that's kind of what these judges are basing their rulings on. So Orrin Hatch was very articulate about it and very, very unequivocal about that. And when we tried to get reaction from other members of the congressional delegation, Representative Jim Matheson did kind of quietly give a statement saying, yes, he agreed that was what was going to happen. Didn't say whether he agreed with that legal analysis or not. But everybody else just sort of ran for cover.
What about others in the GOP? I mean, you were surprised. Are other party loyalists thinking, wow, this guy's a little outspoken on this issue?
Well, I think he can be. He's, as he's said, in his last term. And I think he can be a little more open than he has been in the past. I don't think he has to worry about another election. And, so that maybe gives him some freedom that he hasn't had in the past.
George, what do you think? What do you make of the Hatch statements this week, both on the veterans and on the gay marriage debate?
Well, yeah, what was strange about it was the statements at the Memorial Day were almost like he was worried about being primaried on the right. He has to keep on, keeping his bona fides up with the Tea Party, almost as if he has some political threat looming over him, which he doesn't. He says he's in his last term, and even if he does run again, it's four or five years down the road. He's got more money than anybody, and the idea that he would have to say something like that in order to get his ticket punched just seems very strange. And then you contrast that with what he said about the gay marriage issue, which is where he stands, rises above it all as a guy who's been there forever and seen anything and been on the Judiciary Committee forever, even once in a while, sort of has his name bandied about when there's an opening on the Supreme Court. And so he knows all of this stuff. And when he comes along and says, look, guys, you know, you may not agree with it. I don't agree with it. It's done. Just give it up. Now, what he didn't say, I didn't listen to the program, but what I understand that he did not say was that, so Utah ought to give up its case. So Utah ought to surrender. So the attorney general ought to drop his case. He didn't say that. He didn't get that.
No, he didn't say that. And I don't think that he would say that. He didn't say this directly, but from the context of what he said, it seemed like he was saying, yes, the best case should go forward to the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. and then it will be resolved. You know, we need to have the Supreme Court rule on this issue very, he said, elucidate the issue, yeah. and then whether all Americans are accepted or not, they will be satisfied that it has had, you know, the ultimate legal analysis by the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, no, that makes a certain amount of sense. Make a case, yeah. pursue it all the way to the Supreme Court, but everybody out there understand Utah is probably going to lose, and we're just going to have to deal with it. And he couches it, both the Hobby Lobby case and the gay marriage case, he couches it in terms of religious freedom and trying to make sure that even if the Affordable Care Act stays in place, that people who object to that sort of thing don't have to even indirectly pay for contraceptives if they think that's bad, and that people who churches who don't follow the idea that gay marriage should be legal, churches don't have to participate if they don't want to.
Why didn't he chime in, though, on Utah's case? Governor Herbert, of course, last week creating a bit of a stir, saying it's anarchy if we do not defend our state law. That seems like a natural place for Senator Hatch to sort of jump in, but he didn't. Why?
Well, again, you know, I think that he does want a Supreme Court ruling, so he's not going to – I don't think he's going to say, you know, Utah should just back off and not pursue this appeal. It may be that Utah does have the case that the Supreme Court will use to ultimately decide this decision.
Mm-hmm. Can we expect a more off-the-cuff Hatch during his remaining years in term?
I don't know. You know, it's been interesting because as this has played out, like we had a reporter at the Memorial Day event that captured that, and we kind of had some blowback from the senator's office. We asked for additional comment. They wouldn't comment. The office, not the senator, but the office kind of castigated us for cherry-picking, as they called it, because such a small amount of the senator's speech was devoted to this. And in terms of the gay marriage issue, they wouldn't elucidate that either. They would have no comment. In fact, the office went a whole day without responding to voicemails or emails. So I think he's picking his formats where to be to express these things. So far, they haven't been with the Salt Lake Tribune. I hope that changes in the future. Just one thing on the Memorial Day event, too, that I got to stick up, I think, a little bit for the mayor of Woods Cross here, because the guy was sent a bio that Hatch's office sent, and that's where his remarks that got political came from. And, you know, he told me this, and I believe him. He hadn't reviewed them in advance. He started reading it, and he's in the middle of the thing, and he's kind of going, oh, this isn't good. But, you know, by then it's too late.
Yeah.
And he didn't feel – he felt the same way when Senator Hatch started talking politics. But what does he – poor guy going to do? You know, get a hook and pull the senior senator off the station? No, that's not going to happen.
No.
So that just in his defense.
Speaking with the Tribune's Dan Harry, Mike Carell, and George Pyle, we're talking about the week's news. And we invite you to chime in as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You can also put your comments at sltrib.com. We will be right back after another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And joining me in studio, political and government editor Dan Harry, editorial writer George Pyle, reporter Mike Garrell. And you are welcome to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You can put your comments at sltrib.com, or you can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. Let's talk about the streetcar. Salt Lake City is applying for a federal grant to extend the Sugar House streetcar. And Mike Garrell, you've been covering this. Tell us about the idea.
Right now, the S line terminates at about 10th East and about 22nd South. The long-term plan for that is to have it go up to Highland Drive and then turn north and go to 21st South, that intersection there, and then ultimately beyond that, even though that's quite a controversial proposal. But right now, the grant that the city's looking to get would be $10 million to extend it to 21st South.
Okay, so it's a federal grant. What do people in the neighborhood, those local mom-and-pop shops in that neighborhood, think about this?
I think there's probably some for and some against it.
No uniform voice on it.
Yeah,
huh?
Probably not. But and in part because the city's required to come up with about a $3.1 million match if it gets this federal grant. And the city council is pretty adamant that they're not going to take the whole weight of that out of the city's general fund. And they want to talk to some of the businesses that are along that corridor to try to get their financial participation, since they are going to be the ultimate beneficiaries of extending that line.
So would the federal money cover the whole deal, or does the city have to sort of chip in a little bit too?
Well, about $3.1 million.
$3.1 million.
So it's a hefty chunk of change.
Where's that money going to come from?
They don't know.
Okay, they don't know. So, good idea, George Pyle. Bad idea. If you don't know where the money's coming from, do you just throw that application out there anyway and see what happens?
Well, they're going to have to, I don't know, you know, how committed you have to be to your match, but you don't actually get the federal money until you've got it. And this, you know, reopens the whole can of worms, because there were a lot of people in the neighborhood who thought the idea of turning the streetcar north was a bad idea, the idea that the street's too narrow. The traffic can't handle it. The little shops along the way are going to have their business ruined by all the construction as it goes on. Not everybody thought that, but a lot of people did. And if it later turns out, you know, that streetcar that we sort of forced down your throat that some of you liked and some of you didn't, now we're going to ask you to help pay for it.
Hmm.
You know, and even if it's a relatively small amount of, you know, benefit district kind of thing, their argument is going to be, benefit? What benefit? We're not benefiting from this. You're wrecking the neighborhood. Mm. And then you might, actually, we've had some changes on the city council since the decision was made. You might even reopen the issue of whether the streetcar should turn north at all, whether it should continue east to Sugar House Park and Highland High School, which was the Tribune editorial board's position after we thought about it, was that going north at that narrow street in that neighborhood really wasn't such a good idea.
Hmm. Well, that will be an interesting budget idea to be watching as well. We have a few minutes left, so that means it's our lightning round, the underplayed story of the week. And George, what's your pick?
Well, if you look back in history at this week, probably what will be noticed is that we may actually be ending the war in Afghanistan after, 13 years? Mm-hmm. We elected a president two elections ago who promised to end the war. He did end the war in Iraq, and now he's saying we'll basically be out of Afghanistan except for some fewer than 9,000 troops who are not there to occupy Afghanistan. They're there to go after terrorists. So it may actually come to an end.
Okay. Afghanistan. That's good news, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. But if the Taliban rise again, then history may later judge that we made a mistake there.
Mm. Mike Garrell?
I'm going to pick a topic that's near and dear to Dan's heart, what Salt Lake City is going to do with its golf courses. Because right now the golf course fund has about a $500,000 deficit, and in the mayor's budget for next year, it kind of breaks even, but it doesn't do anything to address that $500,000 deficit. So the plan is to close the Jordan River Par 3 golf course as part of that. And one of the long-term solutions to the golf course's problems, courses in plural, is to they need to get change their watering systems. And right now they're on city treated culinary water, and they're plan to switch over to secondary water, particularly at Bonneville, whose watering system's way out of date and broken down, and it needs to be replaced. And they want to replace it with secondary water, which is much cheaper than treated water.
Okay, so golf on the docket. All right, Dan Harry?
I don't know that it's been underplayed, but I will say that this story of Wasatch High School up in Heber, where they have been altering the images of students there in what they call modesty edits, is quite a fascinating story on many levels, I think. One of the levels is sort of, to me, reading that story, it's sort of an invasion of privacy. That someone could take your image without your knowledge and alter it in ways that make you look different than you actually do in reality. It seems kind of an invasion of privacy. And there are many other levels on that. The inconsistency of that, the idea that, there's no warning label that you're making a photo illustration of it. The fact that there was a real touching story that Aaron Alberti wrote about in the Tribune, mm-hmm. about one young high school girl that had a very tough childhood. She survived a very rough childhood, and she'd gotten a tattoo, which was not, didn't have explicit language or pictures or anything else. It was just a saying that was sort of an empowering mantra for her that she
something
had.
Something like, I am enough or something.
Yeah, the way I am is enough or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they had cut it out because they considered it a tattoo, which I guess is allowed by their school dress code anyway. And I think that really took away her power. I thought that was a very powerful story. Anyway, mm-hmm. that'll be ongoing, and it's getting quite a bit of coverage.
Oh yes, yeah. The scrutiny will continue. George,
I mean, as somebody who started in journalism on his high school yearbook staff and met his wife there, this resonates for me. And one of the things you're talking about is a high school yearbook, is it journalism or is it PR? If it's PR, well, maybe this is the way it goes. If you're trying to train journalists, lesson number one: you alter an image like that, you get fired. You do that at a newspaper, you're out the door. That's the quickest way you can get tossed out of this profession.
One of the interesting questions about this, I think, and the school hasn't answered, is who's making these decisions?
Exactly.
Is the principal going through? Is the staff doing it? Is it a faculty advisor? They won't answer that question.
No, they won't tell us who took back the lunches either. They're not telling us. It's a different school district.
Well, I'm curious to find out, and as this story develops, I'm curious to find out how many schools have this policy, because I'm sure it's not, it's not an isolated incident. Yeah. I'm sure your staffs look at these images all the time. The funny thing is, it struck me in Aaron's story, is that these girls wear this stuff to school. Mm-hmm. It's not like people haven't seen them without sleeves before.
Right.
It's puzzling. We need to move on. My pick is, if you're looking for something fun to do this week, check out the Leonardo at Library Square. Tribune editorial cartoonist and Pulitzer finalist Pat Bagley. He's been working on this mural. He's going to unveil it at a reception tomorrow night. Tickets are $30, and you can find out more at theleonardo.org. And we're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, Mike Gorell, Dan Harry, George Pyle of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, guys, very much.
Thanks,
you. Jennifer.
Have a good weekend.
You too. And we're going to wrap up today's program with a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And this week, he pays respect to his first pocket knife. It's a tool that his father warned him about.
Probably the trouble you could get into with it. You know, you can cut stuff up, let the air out of somebody's tires, shave your little brother's head, stuff like that.
Good wholesome family fun.
Oh, yeah.
This is a column that you wrote about your first pocket knife back in 2004. Tell us a little bit about it and read some for us.
Yeah, it was a pocket knife that my dad gave me, one of these. It's probably the early form of the Leatherman, you know, where it has all the gadgets attached to it. My dad gave it to me. he said, "Do not cut your brothers and sisters," he warned. A few minutes later, he added, "or the dog." By dinner time, his list included everything in the house and most of the neighbors. I was told to keep the knife in my pocket until a specific need for it arose. But it's just amazing how many needs arrive when you finally get a knife. The following morning found me in the bathroom, wondering how I ever got toilet paper off the roll before without a knife. A moment later, I was nursing a bloody knuckle and trying to remember. My first public knife act was to section the garden hose. The second was to surrender the knife to the old man, who saw no merit in the logic that several hoses were better than one. It was the last time I ever saw the knife. My father says he lost it, but more likely he buried it in a deep hole somewhere in the backyard near Canada.
That poor knife. It probably saw some fun, but darn it, it had to go. What kind of knife do you carry today? There it is.
Yep, it is.
It's got a black handle.
Black handle. It comes out automatically. Let's see if we can get it on there.
Ooh, little switchblade action.
Yeah. And
it's probably, what, 4 inches long?
3 3/4 inch.
Okay.
You got to get them under 4 inches so that they'll let you take it on. You know, you can stick it in, carry them into places.
Do you want to share this with us? You're going to get a call from another government official. So what do you use the knife for?
I don't know, operating on my grandkids. No, I mean, it's like everything else. You know, people will pick at things with their fingernails. I just pop out the knife. And my wife she makes fun of me for carrying a knife all the time. But she's always asking me, "You got your knife?" So it's amazing how many needs will arise. I would say neutering cats, but that's probably inappropriate.
Again, the officials will be calling.
The officials will be calling.
Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and he joins us each week with the best from the archive. You can find all of his columns at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a lovely weekend.